You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Jane DeMakos. Good morning, Jane.
Hi, Eric.
It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in and taking this opportunity to talk. And I know it's a bit of a risk and a little awkward. Mm-hmm. But the way we start the show is just with the big question, who are you? Mm-hmm. But it's just to get pieces of qualities of things that you value in life, that you've experienced, or labels that you wear, things that we know, or some stories that are important for starters.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll start with the obvious. I'm a musician and lived in Ithaca for a very long time and have been doing music in Ithaca for a long time in a variety of ways. Went to school here. So, and I think the trajectory is that after many, many years of identifying as a musician, I think I prefer to identify as a humanitarian who does music, I guess.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that's how I would think of it. Mm-hmm. That's how I like to think of it and how I like to practice it.
Right, right. It's about the relationship with human beings through your music is what I'm inferring or interpreting.
Essentially and at core, yeah.
Yeah.
And if it's not that, usually I can't figure out why I'm doing it.
Right.
Actually.
So it's not about your ego? Or less so?
I can't say it's not in there.
Yeah, no. It's,
You know, that would be like impossible task and I would be lying. But it's a practice, a humanitarian practice. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really, really neat. What other labels do you wear?
What other labels?
What is something that we need to know? Is there anything else we need to know to start this before we cut to music?
Labels. I'm married. I'm a wife. It's not a label that I understand that well, you know. So everything, I guess the label would be a practitioner of everything that I'm involved in. How do I be a wife when you know, and how do I, what is this institution that I find myself in, and, you know, so I consider myself a mother without children. I guess that would be a kind of
that's a very powerful statement.
I like to celebrate Mother's Day, and my husband sometimes gets me flowers for Mother's Day, even though I don't have biological children.
Right.
You know, I feel pretty generative, you know. Yeah, kind of constantly generative. I have to sometimes discipline myself not to, like, you know, like I feel an idea coming on, like feel something welling up about, wouldn't that be amazing? And, you know, I have to, you know, discipline myself not to consummate.
Right, or not to take it on.
Yeah, well, it's, it is like that moment of, like, conception, like, okay, let's, like, you know, practice a little birth control here.
right. Well, and self-care.
Absolutely self-care.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm partnered with a person who does not have children and did not want to have children. Mm-hmm. And she is incredibly, is always coming up with the next project or the next ideas.
Right.
And my role is to listen to the story and to hold it, but not necessarily commit to question and to give it a few days, and then we'll see.
Yes, my partner is very similar.
Okay. So, you brought some music with you. What would you like to start with?
I think maybe not the second or the third, because those are very interior.
Right.
The first is just a joyful piece, and that's why I brought it.
And the joy piece from song. Africa, or the
Kronos Quartet. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, something I've always loved.
Here we go. Thank you. that was the Kronos Quartet, Pieces of Africa album, the Washishije, Our Beginning. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Jane DeMakos. So, Jane, what experiences or what have you reflected on or lived through that has helped to kind of put your life in perspective? What do you see as kind of formative moment or a formative experience?
You know, the way we grew up, we had a very challenging family life. And
we is how big a family?
I have two brothers, one on either side. And, you know, we all did the best we could, but there were definitely some challenges and then some personal challenges that I had. And I really think often that I didn't develop a really cohesive ego, so that I could walk through life, and kind of take up my spot. But over the years, I've reflected back and feel like I've always had something pushing me from behind to grow an ego. I don't know how else to say it, but I've often had that feeling like, and so many of the experiences that I've found myself in that I've had to grow some kind of muscle, like I fell in love with choral conducting in my last year of college, and I was terrified of being in front of a group. But, you know, just by sheer love of wanting to do it, I put myself in positions and got jobs and stuff. And before every rehearsal, I would have this like stage fright, actually, you know.
Sure.
But it began to grow a muscle, you know, by which I could develop a skill and develop my confidence and just things like that. And, you know, putting myself on stage singing, when at core I wasn't sure I was worthy of the space I was actually standing on, kind of thing, up a certain way, you know, really has. I think it's not like one story. It's a kind of some more like overarching sense that I've been pushed from behind to grow myself as a human being, right, so that I could do the work that I'm doing now.
And I want to get to the work you're doing now, but I want to talk about. A lot of times we don't know how with friends or children or peers or even parents who don't have that confidence that they can own or be in the space they occupy. And you use this, you use the notion of it's like you had to grow more muscle to occupy that space. And you also used a concept which I will interpret as you loved it so much that you were willing to face, to struggle with the fear. And the love overcomes fear, kind of.
I guess you could say it that way.
Or love counters fear and gives you space to grow the muscle.
Well, I guess if you consider the love of it as a force.
Yeah.
It wasn't like I choose to love. It was more like a force that... Yeah.
Right. And this is where love is not about aesthetic appreciation.
No.
Love is a relationship or a force to be reckoned with. And that, at least I have an experiential approach to things. And so that's how I would frame it. And yet, so what worked for you? What kinds of things worked for you to grow that muscle? And what things didn't?
Like I say, putting myself in situations, getting jobs that I could, you know, do the work that I loved. The first time I heard that I was in front of a group and we did four-part harmony, I got a speeding ticket on the way home because I was just so, I was so ecstatic to be in the middle of this, and so I kept doing it. But, you know, I would say I got battered a lot because there were people who were better than me, and then I perceived people better than me. So I'm actually not sure I could say there is anything that did not work. I can't think of something that did not work.
So you never felt knocked down to the point that you couldn't pick yourself back up?
No. I mean,
You thought that at the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I never stopped, you know. I mean, I think in the I don't know this. I would call it like a soul gesture of the right to be happy.
Uh huh.
Is a pervasive gesture that seems to run through my life, so that even if I had a bad experience, it wasn't. It's like, no, you know, I keep going. I have a right to fulfill a kind of human birthright to be happy.
Right. Right. And the soul, S-O-L-E or S-O-U-L?
S-O-U-L.
So the soul gesture,
yeah,
of the right to be happy. That's a practice. Can,
yes,
you explain where that comes from?
No. I was born with it, I think. Uh-huh. I don't know.
Uh-huh. And so that is a phrase of your own.
I just came up with it just now.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's a very powerful phrase. This is not a trivial use of the word happy.
No.
This is approaching what some people would use joy, but without all the presumptive fireworks.
Yes.
That come with that term.
Correct.
When did you discover that? I mean, you just claimed you coined the phrase
now.
Now.
I don't know. I think the same thing as I'm going along and I'm living my life. I mean, I just, you know, in college, I was just such a misfit, you know, like, mm-hmm, I was a social misfit. This girlfriend, she remembers me as just walking around college. I was kind of like, I would be like goth. The mm-hmm goth now would be like me then. I wrote dark poetry and I practiced 5 hours a day. I had long braids and walked around and I didn't talk, and I was a social misfit, you know.
You weren't an outcast.
I wasn't an outcast.
But you didn't fit in.
I didn't fit in, but I had friends, you know, and, mm-hmm, you know, there's just this, and I had a night shift at the old Ithacare, you know, this retirement home.
Back in,
yes,
the old hospital building?
Yeah. And, you know, it was great to have a night shift, and I stayed up all night writing poetry, and there was this like, rich kind of inner life that just kept turning itself over, like composting it over and over again. I think if I hadn't had art, if I hadn't been writing, hadn't been playing piano, when I was younger, I did painting and sculpture later. I think I probably would not have made it, I'm going to guess. I think
Why do you say that?
Because there was this, as I say, this kind of composting of my inner life, mm-hmm, over and over again, and keep revisiting things, and material would come up on its own, and I had an outlet for it.
Mm-hmm.
That if I didn't, I think the illness from not expressing something like that would be depression, that perhaps would have, I might not have overcome.
Right. And what I hear is you were doing the composting over and over again, even as you were working and making a living and supporting yourself.
Yes, absolutely.
And that is a there was a certain balance. I infer a certain kind of balance.
No, I was not balanced. It was a necessity. I would never say that I was balanced.
No, I didn't say you were balanced. Okay. I would say there was a balance between the working to make the ends meet and to support yourself, and the intensity of the reflection and the composting things over and over again. That doesn't lead to a whole balanced life, but the tension between being,
yes, tension is probably a
better
word,
being productive,
yes,
and being deeply reflective, yes, in a way that you don't know if the compost is going to grow anything until you've let it sit out for a while.
Yes.
You know, and then used it.
Yes.
And but people oftentimes rush themselves.
What do you mean by that?
I think in a culture where there's a sense that we need to be moving forward or need to be achieving or need to be doing stuff.
Right.
But if you are taking care of yourself, you're feeding yourself and housing yourself, and you're doing this intensely reflective stuff, especially early in life.
Yeah.
There's nothing to worry about in my sense, because once you're ready, you'll come out. You will step out, or you'll grow, or those things will be generative on their own.
I suppose.
Yeah. That's just been my.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean that. Yeah.
It didn't seem so certain to you when you were living through it.
No. It was like a fire, a fire. And I think the word necessity is probably a key word, mm-hmm. And it makes me, right now, thinking about, the state of the arts in our culture and how important it is. It's if it's a necessity for someone, it has to be available,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So for me, it was a necessity,
And what is it about the arts that is the necessity? What was it, this composting that you're talking about? Or what did you do? What art did you make at those times?
I was always drawing and things like that, even as a young girl.
Mm-hmm.
But then I remember when I began to go underground as a teen, mm-hmm. and I really, it was like abduction, like Persephone gets abducted by Hades. I'm living in this underworld. I was mentored by a creative writing teacher in high school, and he pretty much saved my skin, because he saw the need to be expressive and really let me write. He let me write what I needed to write. Mm-hmm. So it was not in a box of any kind. And I just wrote up a storm. And I was also lived in the art room. And I was, painting and sculpting and things like that. And for no other reason than I was like compelled to do it. It was just kind of pouring out of me. And it was a lot of really dark stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He loved Sylvia Plath, and I was reading Sylvia Plath. And I realized I took on Thomas Wolfe, I realized I had these voices that became integrated into my voice. I don't know if I ever found my true voice. Perhaps I'm doing that now as a young girl. And then I was playing piano, and mm-hmm. studying classical piano, and then I quit piano, and then I was given a guitar, put a guitar in my hand, and I'm making, writing songs and, lyrics, Joni Mitchell like lyrics, and, it was like that. It was just, mm-hmm. it really was the reason to be alive. I can't remember mm-hmm. much else. I can't remember academic classes. I can't
remember,
zero,
Right. So you went to college.
Mm-hmm.
You were a social misfit, but then you went to work at Ithacare.
I did, yes.
Mm-hmm. And
putting myself through school,
right? Right.
Part time,
right? And so, when did you feel that you were stepping out of that space? Because it seems
which
like
space? What's the space?
The space was the incredibly tension. Of the darker stuff and not being at peace with it.
Okay.
When did you begin to? I mean, did you make peace with it, or have you?
I think more recently, and as I reflect back, I'm becoming coherent. I'm becoming someone who can be in a meeting and like have a dialogue in a meeting and, have projects and work with a larger body or a board or someone about mm-hmm. this project and have a conversation about it without feeling like that introverted kind of folding door, like a folding back into myself.
Right. You don't have to overcome yourself in order to be present.
No, that I would say in the last 15 years, maybe mm-hmm. And I would say. Especially when I started working at Hospice Care, and I was looking for a long time about what should I do, and I taught in the public school system, mm-hmm. For a year, and I worked in the church for 10 years, and there were all really valuable in lots of ways, and I actually loved working in the church, you know. Mm-hmm. Especially in the beginning, there was the pastor there who just gave me free license, and, you know, somehow spiritually it worked for me. I don't know if it would right now, but it did then. And mm-hmm. But when I went into hospice work as a musician, when I discovered there was actually a field that was called music thanatology. Mm-hmm. And when I discovered there was a field and that I wanted to do, this is what I wanted to do, mm-hmm. it became very grounded work for me. And I think that ground really helped me. And I have to say, my marriage has helped me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just given me, you know, someone who believes in me, and, you know, I'm not a social misfit. I have a sense mm-hmm. of belonging. And then our belonging as a couple in the larger community has really helped me. But working at hospice care, becoming certified in my field, and now I'm working towards another certification, growing my understanding of that work and my, I want to say conviction. It's, I don't want to say like I, you know, like, credo, you know,
right.
I have a belief. Yeah. It's not, I try not to be rigid, but I see that this, what works in this work and how valuable it is, and I can speak on its behalf, and I can work on its behalf and grow programs mm-hmm. on its behalf, which is what's happening, you know.
And that's the muscle that expresses rather than folds in on itself.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Did you get married and start the hospice work at about the same time, or were they...
I had not a good marriage, you know, mm-hmm. that was really not so great. That did not support me. But I've been married 5 years, mm-hmm. so yeah. I'm a newlywed,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but hospice, I've been in hospice for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a bunch
of
things.
It's part of growth. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what you described, when you are with others who are in hospice, people are pretty conscious of their dying. Or they're in that being living while they're dying, that puts a floor on things. At least it has for me when I've worked as an oncology mm-hmm. chaplain or as a with a dialysis unit or with HIV/AIDS, it just kind of allows things to just be that you don't have to work at, because people will relate to you or not.
That's right.
In very direct ways, mm-hmm. and you can be of service or not, mm-hmm. and there's no sweat in it. That would seem to have given you an opportunity to live with more directness than a lot of people are in their work.
Right. I think the less mask you have, but with a strong sense of self,
mm-hmm.
The better,
mm-hmm.
you know. Because when people are dying and they're getting stripped of things, and to be able to meet them on their level and then begin to understand how music could support them in their disease process or their psychosocial
mm-hmm.
situation or whatever, their spiritual life is a big one.
Mm-hmm.
How I can, as a musician support that. Yeah. Whatever you just said, yeah.
No, it's powerful, and it's also kind of an extension from Ithacare. You know, an older population and end of life, you know.
I suppose, although a large...
I'm a
music thanatologist, but also I have a certification in... I'm not a music thanatologist. I'm working towards that certification now. I'm a certified therapeutic harpist. In that capacity, it's very broad.
Right.
And I go into all the nursing homes, and that's much more like Ithacare.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm working with people, you know, 80s and 90s, many of whom have Alzheimer's and dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some very wonderful situations that... you know, Kendall and, you know, Longview, and some very difficult situations at Cougar Ridge and Beechtree, because mm-hmm. they're Medicaid funded and understaffed, and they don't have the same resources, so
right.
it's much right. harder.
Right. What do you? I'm going to do the station ID, and let's cut to music,
sure.
and then we'll come back to this.
Okay.
You're listening to WRFI Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Jane DeMakos. So, Jane, what should we play next?
Let's see. You know, there's so much music when four pieces is like seemed impossible. So I used right. a little bit of a, it's not really a formula, but, you know, the ancient bards had three strains of music that they needed to be able to play to
be complete musicians?
To be able to be a bard.
I see, okay. Yeah.
And to work their bardshipness.
Okay.
And it's a tear song, a joy song, and a sleep song. So I picked the joy song to begin with, and we could, and then the next one is the tear song. So you could play the tear song.
Which is?
The second one.
Okay.
La Primavera.
And, yes. And do you want, Owain, how do you pronounce the performer?
Actually, I'm not actually sure.
Owain Fife.
Fife, yeah.
La prima vez que te vi de tus ojos me enamoré. La prima vez que te vi de tus ojos me enamoré. Da aquel momento te amé, fin a la tomba te amaré. Da aquel momento te amé, fin a la tomba te amaré. Acércate, mi querida salvadora de mi vida. Acércate, mi querida salvadora de mi vida. Descúbrete y háblame secretos de la tu vida. Descúbrete y háblame secretos de la tu vida.
To WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Jane DeMakos. So Jane, when you go into the nursing home or into hospice with your harp or whatever
mm-hmm.
music, where
harp,
you
sing,
you
yeah.
go with your harp,
mm-hmm.
you also sing.
Mm-hmm.
What are you looking for in terms of connection or what is it that you're bringing into that setting and offering the residents and the staff?
And the staff. I think at best it's an open space, not an empty space, you know, a space that has turned over a lot of things in my life so that I can put them down or maybe understand those parts of being human so that they're not a surprise to me or a block. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I don't quite know how to express it, but there's in the training there's a lot of self-reflective work, which I love, and then a kind of intimacy. Mm-hmm. So that I can be in human relationship and then begin to respond musically. So one of the things that's often done in this work is that you breathe with a person and play with their breathing. I don't want to say that like always because there's really no real formulas and, you know, it's not really like that, but it's that level of intimacy of really breathing with someone and then beginning to phrase with their breathing and maybe to understand a little bit about, you know, where their heart is, I mean, in a feeling sense. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Or maybe sometimes that's not even available. If I go into Cayuga Ridge and I'm working with Alzheimer's and dementia, some things are just not available. Some people are really not available. Not on that spectrum and not like we're used to. And, mm-hmm. you know, people are often put away when they're 80s mm-hmm. and 90s. Mm-hmm. So we don't have that much practice. And it's a real shame. And it makes it worse for everybody. So if I can, the willingness to try to reach someone on their level is, you know, I would say in the nursing home especially, nursing home work, especially the Medicaid supported ones, are much harder work for me than hospice.
Right, right. No, I
it's just, yeah.
For what you have described in terms of entering the room, you are a person with substantial resources to bring into the space.
I would say.
But your focus mm-hmm. is not those resources.
No.
It's an openness to be, and there's, you've got to be comfortable with the resources so you can ignore
right.
the ones that aren't relevant.
Exactly.
And let go
exactly.
of them and push aside. And you're
That's
just
well
what you're
said.
Describing
Thank
is non-attachment,
yeah.
spiritual indifference in the Ignatian
no.
version or not. No. Where you can be aware of something but mm-hmm. not attached to doing mm-hmm. it. And then when you're observing the person, you're taking them in. What I'm hearing, and I'm inferring stuff here too, is you'll notice their breathing, you'll notice mm-hmm. their posture, you'll notice the sounds that they make or the way that mm-hmm. that they move, and you try to align your relationship so that it conforms to what they are sending out to you.
Or what they're presenting.
Or presenting to you.
You know,
yeah.
presenting.
Yeah.
Something like that. You know, I think at root it gets back a little bit to something I said before about the birthright, you mm-hmm. know, of happiness. And I think that people, even people with advanced Alzheimer's that appear to be unreachable, mm-hmm. I think that deep down people respond to love and respond to being seen by another human being. And I think there's a, you know, if there's any chance of restoring a sense of human value, even with someone with, you know, advanced Alzheimer's, it's if they feel like perhaps they're touched, they can be reached by love, by which they're really seen for where they're at,
mm-hmm.
you know. So if someone's in the nursing home crying, get me out of here, get me out of here, get me out of here, no one has time to listen to them, and then people become numb to it. But actually, they're saying something.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying something, and they're calling out for something, and maybe it isn't even exactly what they're saying, but to kind of be with them and wait and to listen to them, not say anything necessarily, but listen to them. And maybe there's a piece of music that can really access, if you can you know, take some experimentation, but you can perhaps access something very deep that they can begin to turn towards you. I've seen that turning towards, you know, where they haven't turned in a really long time.
They haven't acknowledged and, anyone present.
Yes, and it's an amazing thing, and it's a hard thing. It's taxing, actually, to wait, and maybe it does work, and maybe it doesn't work, but if there's any chance in hell, you know, it's going to be through love, you know, and a very specific kind of love, not sentimental. It's really, you know, the willingness to hold out that there's a person in there.
Right, and... particularly, I grew up, child care for me when my mom was working as a nurse's aide and then as was hanging out at the nursing home until she got off work to drive us home.
Yeah.
And so I spent time around people, many of whom had severe dementia. And the most, later in life, not that much later, but when I was about 20, I visited my step-grandmother, and in the course of a 20-minute conversation, I was all the important men in her life. I was her first husband who was murdered, her second husband who was my grandfather, her her son who died on the beach in Normandy, her son who was a captain in an ocean liner, and her father, and all these people. And I kind of knew the players.
Yeah.
And I didn't need to fix her.
Exactly.
And I knew, and this was back in 1979, and I knew that that wasn't a good thing to do, so I just rolled with it. And then I realized, you know, I don't have to be me who I think I am in order to have an impact here, and that's just fine. And later in chaplaincy training, that became more of the kind of the one of the qualities you aspire to develop, to allow people to just show themselves and to connect where they are ready. And when I hear you connecting with music, I also know that persons with Alzheimer's, sometimes music, especially if it comes from a time in their life when they were deeply committed to it, can suddenly reorient them.
Absolutely. They can sing all of the lyrics of something they may not have been speaking, and their memory may be totally non-contextual, and you know every word.
And that moment is an engagement, and it's not that there wasn't an engagement in the other moment, but you're not aware of it, not in that way.
Right.
At the end of the day, because I would imagine that you go through many different experiences by the end of the day.
I do. It's a long day too.
And if you are emotion, if you're, you said you're offering people a kind of intimacy, and. I would say that it's there for all of us, but most of the time we don't look that closely.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't look that closely, we're not going to engage it because we have like a job to do, and we're going to do it to them or with them or for them, but we're not going to just be with them or be with ourselves, even for that matter. So when you have, and I'm going to use your muscle language, when you've exercised that muscle in so many ways over the course of the day, what do you need to take care of at the end of the day?
Learning to say no is a big one. You know, if I really feel like I've reached a point where I can't give anymore and I get a phone call that somebody's dying in the hospital and they'd like me to come, it's hard to say no. But, you know, I just have to think for 2 seconds about, can I actually show up and be that open, draw upon my resources, If I come up with no, I don't think I can, I have to say no, and that's a challenge. But learning to say no has been a big one, and really just letting go of the day, you know, letting go of it. Not we have 2 dogs, 2 greyhounds, you know, just being an animal with them is always a good thing. Rolling around on the floor with them, you know, it's like, oh great, it's great to be an animal right now, you know, things like that, you know, just having a nice dinner. And then, you know, if I can write, if I then later some other time I can turn it over, you know, compost it, you know,
or just let it go and see if it comes back in the compost.
Exactly. That's what writing is. There's no, you just have to wait and listen to see what wants to come up. There's no like agenda. As soon as there's an agenda, there's no writing, you know.
How do you manage the transition when you walk back in the door at home, or do you do the transition before you walk in the door?
Depends. If I'm lucky enough, I'm in Cortland and I get to drive home for 40 minutes.
Right.
And that turns out to be a good thing. If I'm just up the hill on South Hill and I come right home, you know, and it can be really late, you know, sometimes I don't manage it so well. So,
right.
You know, sometimes I manage it by the next day, I'm managing it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can have a morning, you know, a lazy morning, you know, sometimes it's the next morning where I manage it. So, yeah.
Are you, is this acceptance, or I would say almost giving or forgiving of yourself the space to do that? Is that something that you kind of eased into, how have you learned to just acknowledge that it's a different process and it takes the time it takes?
Experiment. You know, I experiment. I mean, I think for a really long time, if I feel like it is not balanced and I've put out so much and I haven't nourished myself, and I feel that I start feeling like it's like a temperature barometer meter that I have about my well-being,
mm-hmm.
I will just take the day off, you know. It's just a bed day, you know.
Right. I mean, what some people call a mental health day.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but it's a self-care day.
Yeah, I just do that, you know, if I can, you know, and I really try to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I like to do is to ask people, what do you do on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly, regular basis to take care of yourself, uh-huh. emotionally, intellectually, physically? For people who have them, what are the spiritual practices, or what are the disciplines, however defined, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. you do? And we've already kind of started into that conversation.
Yeah. Not a very disciplined person. I'm really my mother's daughter in that way. But I, you know, I have to be mindful. So, mindfulness is probably one of the main things, which is great because you don't have to sit on a cushion to do it. You can do it anywhere. You breathe, remember. I walk. You know, if mm-hmm. I can walk someplace, I walked here this morning. It's great. And sometimes I walk to like...
How long a walk is that?
It's half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a little over a mile. I'll walk back again, mm-hmm. you know. I listen to Bob Marley or something, you know. Uh-huh. I love Bob Marley and Stevie Wonder, you know, and it gets me up the hill. There's that hill, West Hill part that's really steep, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so stuff like that. I do have a spiritual practice. I've been meditating since the 70s, you know, and studying spiritual teachers since the 70s, and it has supported me, and it also has been a huge piece of my life as a musician,
mm-hmm.
learning how to, I would say, be a contemplative has taught me more about being a musician than anything except for the outright skills that you need, like theory and technique,
right.
and stuff like that.
What does the life of contemplation or meditation bring to you as a musician?
I learned to hear Beethoven through meditating with Beethoven, late Beethoven sonatas. And
so having the music around you.
I studied with a teacher that the first thing we went into meditation, we listened to late Beethoven,
mm-hmm.
Mahler, you know, and that was the first. We meditated, and then it became silent,
mm-hmm.
for another 45 minutes. These were probably hour meditations.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to hear something that isn't really teachable. That teacher taught me more about being a musician than any of my teachers did. So that's still part of my practice, you know, both just to sit in silence, to learn how to be in silence, to mm-hmm. learn how to be with my mind. So mindfulness is different than contemplative practice,
right.
But I have experience with both. I studied with Thich Nhat Hanh in Plum Village. You know, the capacity just to be with one's mind, to be with one's breath. So I would say intimacy with oneself, mm-hmm. which also serves my work. These are things that I do in a daily way that support me, mm-hmm. you know. Then there's just having fun, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know.
What do you do for, what is your play?
Rolling around on the floor with the dogs, dancing, if I can dance, you know, it's just great. It's just great. And then Carrie and I love to watch movies, you know, and we have a little notebook. We write all the movies in and we rate them and stuff like that, you know, and, you know, just watching movies, cooking, eating, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah, being with friends is a big one. You know, being with girlfriends, we do things like, I remember having a birthday party once and we all wore wigs, you know.
Right,
yeah. yeah. Crazy wigs to this birthday party, you know, and brought great food and laughed. Mm-hmm.
So laughter and play and joy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Joy for sure. Yeah. Yeah, more joy, yeah, better. I'm a pretty serious person, so the joy part is good.
Right, and it's a joy that you can take it, grab it.
That's right.
And play with it, and you can put it back on the shelf, or you can sidle up to it.
Yeah, yeah.
I get it. I mean, those are the images that come to mind. How did you, when you started meditating in the 70s in college,
yeah.
or
mm-hmm.
yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Was your early experience with the music? Was your earliest experience listening to music first and then going into silence?
That was a large part. I was a member of a community, a very strong community on Seneca Lake, mm-hmm. Wisdom's Goldenrod. And,
oh, yeah.
yeah. And, you know, it was a very broad umbrella of spiritual study and depth psychology. So Jung, you know, and the Greeks, Plotinus and stuff like that, really over my head, but somehow I was compelled to be there, you know.
Yeah.
And every day, we meditated every day.
Mm-hmm.
And we wouldn't always start with music, but it was more often than not we would start with mm-hmm. music. So mm-hmm. I would say, yes, right in the beginning, deep listening. And it's not listening to. That's the thing, the learning to...
To take it in.
It's almost like... Well, sometimes I feel like it's playing me.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I don't know. And then it gets very deep and it gets very connected to my heartbeat. I can't really, it's not something that I can really, I'd have to work hard to put language on it that would really express it.
It sounds like it washes over you and you absorb it, or it is, in that sense, that's the image that comes to my mind.
It's not quite like that, though. It's like to actually hear. It's profoundly deep hearing, as a profoundly deep hearing,
yeah.
But it's not to it,
right?
I can't. And then it became part. And then playing, like if I would be playing a Beethoven sonata and having that hearing mm-hmm. in my playing,
right.
You know, I'm grateful.
I had never thought about the experience of music in that way. I began to learn to meditate in the summer of 79. I worked on a construction crew. Mm. We took a meditation break in the afternoon.
Oh, that's so great.
Instead of a cigarette
that's
break.
So amazing.
So it was good.
For you.
It was in Ithaca.
So,
where else? Right. But in that course of that summer, I sat for an hour twice a day, but usually by myself.
Mm.
And after mm-hmm. they had kind of walked me through some basic instructions.
Uh-huh.
And the coming out of meditation, everything was so vibrant, mm. all the sounds, and mm-hmm. it did feel like some of them were in me, some of them were outside mm-hmm. of me, but it became a whole different relationship mm-hmm. with space and sound
mm-hmm.
Because of it. But I didn't think about leading into it
right.
that way.
Right.
Interesting. So where is your spiritual practice, where is your work headed? Where do you see yourself? Where is the path leading you now? Is there any direction, or are you just...
The path is about trust
mm-hmm.
and not really knowing the path.
Right.
And
So greater openness.
And I think the just like musical, we're talking about listening to music, deep listening in my life, you know, deep listening with patience, deep listening in writing, what wants to be the next, you know, for a while I was composing there, and it was like, what wants to be the next note?
Right.
What wants to be the next note? And I would actually hear it, and I composed that way. So, you know, trying not to force things, trying not to make things happen, listening to what wants to happen, you know, true birthing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and I guess, my framing of the question, I wanted to get at that sort of answer, but I framed it in a more linear, mechanical sort of way, rather than the expanding.
Yeah. I do have to say, though, that right now something very particular is happening in that my brother and I are caring for my elderly mother. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my life is about caring for her with him and being with her. Mm-hmm. And so that is something, it's known, but I don't know how long, but it's really defining my life right now, mm-hmm. you know, in a very beautiful way.
Right. What is the beauty that you know now that you did not know before?
Well, she is just, it's, you know, we grew up with a lot of challenging stuff, and I never dreamed that we would have this time where she would just be this kind of open, funny, cuddly. We did not grow up this way.
Right.
And my brother also, I didn't grow up with him that way, and it's just the most precious gift. I would never have expected it.
Life has burnished you into persons in relationship now in ways that you weren't.
These two in particular.
Yeah.
Makes me want to cry. I'm crying a little bit.
Jane, it has been a delight to get to know
you. Thank you, Eric. It's hard. Same here.
This hour has flown.
You made it easy.
and you wanted to close with a piece of fantasy on an English tune.
Yeah. I only wanted to close with it because it's on my first album and on my second album. Nicholas Walker is on it, who I know has been on your show.
Yes.
And he's playing viola da gamba on it. People don't know him as a viola da gamba player, only as a bass player. And Nicholas and I have played a bunch together, and I think we're really fond of each other and have great respect. And so I just wanted to close with something on my album. So that's the reason it's there.
And thank you for bringing it, and thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you.
Thank you.